Welcome back. During my last lecture, I talked about the development of political complexity in states in Southeast Asia, culminating in the extraordinary site of Angkor, the second capital of the Khmer Empire, the Khmer State. The sorts of themes that I wanted to emphasize when looking at Southeast Asia particularly include, I think, the necessity of understanding ancient states in many areas of the world as reflecting both elements of indigenous culture and indigenous dynamism and external contacts with and influences from other societies. This is a general relationship between the internal processes of development and external contacts. It doesn't take anything away from our evaluation of the originality of ancient states to consider the balance between these different processes. Now I want to shift focus. I want to talk about how states came into being in different parts of Africa. I want to do this for a number of reasons. First, because state formation in Africa, as elsewhere, displays a number of interesting parallels and contrasts with cases in other parts of the world. It's an important region. If we want to understand the development of states and civilizations more broadly, then we need to take account of the African cases we know of. But there are other reasons as well. Going to look at Africa because African cases of state formation and African civilizations are too often shamefully ignored in surveys of the origins of states and civilizations, under outmoded and today usually unconscious assumptions that African states could not have developed without outside inspiration. And this goes back to this issue, this theme that I just spoke about. The assumption that African populations lacked the inspiration to develop states on their own is both profoundly insulting and factually incorrect. I also want to speak about Africa because I work in Africa, in Central Africa, and I find the different parts of Africa, the archaeological challenges of research in Africa, and the cultures of Africa, fascinating. I tell my students at Bowdoin that no one ever gets away in my courses without learning some African prehistory. It really doesn't matter what aspect of archaeology I'm talking about. There's probably going to be some work in Africa in there, and more particularly, the prehistory of the Lake Chad Basin in Central Africa. And you now find yourselves in the position of my Bowdoin students. So, here we go. People sometimes make an assumption that indigenous states and urban centers appeared later in sub-Saharan Africa than in other parts of the world. I far too often hear this, an assumption that states in Africa must be in some sense the result, as I said, of contacts from other parts of the world, perhaps the Arab world, perhaps European contact. But in fact, the sorts of processes that we're examining in this series of lectures occur at times that are contemporary with, or in some cases even earlier than, similar kinds of events, similar kinds of processes in Southeast Asia. You'll note, for example, during this lecture that the periods that I'm talking about are broadly the same as those I was talking about in Southeast Asia. The processes towards state formation are essentially contemporary in the two areas, and for that matter, in Europe, north of the Mediterranean basin. It's not as if we can say, in any sense, that these processes are later in Africa than in other parts of the world. We're going to begin this survey of African states by looking at the development of civilization on and around the Ethiopian plateau in northeastern Africa, in the Horn of Africa. This is an extremely interesting area to an important degree. Ethiopia has maintained a distinct cultural identity within Africa over an extremely long period of time, in part because of the environments of the Ethiopian plateau. Thus, for example, Ethiopian agricultural systems include a whole variety of plant domesticates, cereals like teff, root crops like enset, also known as the false banana, noog, an oil plant, Ethiopian peas, a whole variety of different plant domesticates that are more or less unique to the region. I've already spoken about the ways in which we need to understand the economic and I think especially the agricultural underpinnings of ancient states, because in so many ways these determine the potentials of political centralization, social differentiation in these ancient societies. So we have, at the one hand, then, a cultural distinctiveness of Ethiopia. At the same time, and as with Southeast Asia, precisely as with Southeast Asia, Ethiopia lies poised between different cultural worlds, influenced by developments in the Nile Valley, in both Egypt and Sudan, developments in the Arabian Peninsula, but forging its own distinct cultural and political traditions from both indigenous and foreign elements. One important area of contact was, as I noted, with the Nile Valley, particularly in Sudan, where powerful states contemporary with that of pharaonic Egypt had developed in processes that begin during the 3rd millennium BC. And we see a steady development of political systems in this part of the Nile Valley in Sudan, south of Egypt, from the 3rd millennium BC onward. Contact between Ethiopia and the Nile Valley would have passed through the Butana and Kassala areas of eastern Sudan. This is an extremely interesting region, and a region that, as with many other areas of Africa, is not extensively studied archaeologically, although there have been very fine archaeological research projects undertaken there, and very informative research projects undertaken there. The results demonstrate the cultural consequences of living in a crossroads area. Archaeologists working in this part of eastern Sudan have found evidence for both pastoral populations, some possibly also cultivating cereal crops, from the 4th millennium BC onward, and then substantial agricultural villages between about 3500 BC and 1000 BC. So these are not recent by any means. We're speaking now of an agricultural tradition that is ancient and well-established and, by all means, by all accounts, very productive. Some of these villages, like Mahal Teglanos near Kassala, are more than 30 acres in size, with very large amounts of cultural deposits, deep cultural deposits. These were substantial village sites. The largest of these villages displays two characteristics significant to our topic in these lectures. They seem, in the first place, to be part of wide networks of exchange that linked the Egyptian and the Sudanic Nile Valley, on the one hand, up and down the Nile, with the Red Sea coast, the Horn of Africa, and with Ethiopia. So, exchange and trading networks first. They also display evidence for increases in social and political hierarchy, for developments of social and political hierarchy, with some burials containing luxury goods. These centers, places like Mahal Teglanos, apparently controlling smaller and dependent hamlets around them. So some degree of settlement hierarchy. These are themes that I've noted as significant in other areas of the world as well. So this part of Eastern Sudan seems to really show significant development of agricultural systems, of social systems, and of political systems through the 3rd and 2nd millennia BC. What of Ethiopia itself? Well, South Semitic-speaking populations today occupy much of northern Ethiopia, while populations in most of the rest of the country speak languages belonging to the Cushitic language group. These both Semitic and Cushitic languages are part of a larger family that I've talked about in earlier lectures, the Afroasiatic family. It appears that this patterning of Semitic speakers in the north and Cushitic speakers further to the south is due to the gradual migration of Semitic-speaking populations from Arabia, particularly in the period between about 2000 BC and 500 BC, but also afterwards, and perhaps before that as well. At this point, we know linguistically that a language spread and probably a population movement occurred, but we do not know what the impulses behind this language spread and probable population movement actually were. We don't know why it happened. One important question for archaeologists working in the Horn of Africa, working in Ethiopia and Eritrea, is then, should we understand the appearance of political centralization and states in this area as the result of indigenous developments, of contacts from the earlier Bhutana and Kassala sites in eastern Sudan, or from contacts across the Red Sea in southern Arabia, or all of the above? As I've noted, this is to some degree a false choice, in that we can understand states as developing for a whole variety of different reasons, developing according to their own internal dynamics, but at the same time benefiting economically, politically, and yes, culturally and perhaps ideologically, from contacts with other areas in this region of Africa. Developments towards states seem to originate in two different regions. First, around Asmara, the capital of the modern state of Eritrea. And second, in Tigray, in what's now northeastern Ethiopia. By the very early first millennium BC, a number of sites of what's known as the Ona culture existed around Asmara, around the capital of Eritrea. These were large permanent village sites with stone architecture. And Ona sites were built through most of the first millennium BC. Their architecture and the other material culture associated with them, ceramics and so on. These things mark them as largely indigenous to the area, although there are some general resemblances between Ona ceramics and ceramics from Kassala at places like Mahal Teglanos. Ona people were farmers and pastoralists, and they cultivated a mix of indigenous Ethiopian cereal crops, like teff, and foreign cereal crops, wheat. So again, this syncretism, this use of both indigenous and external cultural elements from a wide area. The connections that Ona cites appear to have had with regions in Sudan, and potentially through the use of wheat, for example, in southern Arabia. Elaborate bronze grave goods were found on a burial site near Asmara called Maitemeni and dated to about 400 BC. This may be a late Ona site, but the relationship between the burial site and the Ona settlement sites has not yet been established. In any case, it certainly shows that some individuals were being interred with high-status grave goods in this region in the latter part of the first millennium BC. Contemporary sites to the south of Asmara in Eritrea include places like Matara and Keskese, and possibly the very large urban site of Kohaito, which is extremely impressive, but has not yet been excavated. These sites, especially Kohaito, have striking stone architecture, and also carved stone stelae, or upright stone slabs, that are in some cases 3 to 4 meters or 10 to 12 feet long. And as we'll see, those stelae in much larger forms will be characteristic of later Ethiopian civilization as well. By about the same period, in the late first millennium BC, archaeologists see the establishment of complex settlements, fairly large settlements in Tigray, in what is now northeastern Ethiopia. Sites like Yeha are often called pre-Aksumite, for reasons I'll get to in a moment. They're usually dated to between about 500 BC and 1 AD. They've not been extensively excavated to this point, simply because there's so much work to do on other sites in the region as well, and relatively not that many archaeologists to do it. So we don't know a great deal about them. We do know that some of these sites are quite large. Relatively little archaeology has been done in this region to this point, but there are some contacts with the Sabaean culture in Yemen. This is especially the case with pre-Aksumite inscriptions, written inscriptions, that are in a Sabaean text, written in a Sabaean script, some of which bear royal titles. So it appears that there was some adoption of writing systems across the Red Sea. Royal titles. This, of course, raises two questions. First, obviously, what kind of political system existed in Tigray in the late first millennium BC, with royal titles being applied to individuals? Second, did this political system, however it worked, originate in Ethiopia or across the Red Sea in Yemen? Some archaeologists claim to have resolved this issue by describing a powerful pre-Aksumite state in northern Ethiopia in the mid-late first millennium BC, which they provisionally call Damt or Damat. Other archaeologists doubt that there's enough real evidence to support that conclusion of a large centralized state, pointing out, for example, that the mere use of the title for a king in an inscription does not, of itself, establish a state. It does, of course, raise the question of why writing systems were established, were borrowed across the Red Sea. And, as I noted, this does not resolve the issue of where that state originated, in Ethiopia or in Yemen. Understanding the political system in place in northern Ethiopia during the latter part of the first millennium BC is certainly going to require more research. But the Eritrean data imply the existence of large towns, like Keskese and Cohaito, and important differences in social status and wealth, as indicated, for example, by the burial goods at Mai Temanai, between the Ethiopian highlands and the Red Sea. So whether we're speaking of a single large unified state or not, that may or may not be the case, but urbanism, social difference certainly exists in this part of northeastern Africa by the late first millennium BC. Perhaps the most striking thing about the prehistory of this part of northeastern Africa during this time period is this evidence for large scale interaction, long distance interaction over large areas from the Nile Valley in Sudan to Yemen. This does not imply that states and civilizations were introduced into Ethiopia from either area, or indeed, because people don't tend to think of this, that Ethiopians introduced these innovations to, for example, Yemen. Long distance trade, contact, and exchange coexist with indigenous economic, social, and political processes, and both combined in this region to form a cultural milieu of great vitality. By early in the first century AD, there's a transition to an undoubted state in the region around Aksum in northern Ethiopia. Note that I mentioned the pre-Aksumite designation for earlier societies in this area, and of course, those are so designated because of their relationship to Aksum and the Aksumite state. This Aksumite state lasted until about the 8th century AD. Aksum appears essentially to be a gradual development from pre-Aksumite times. So there's a continuing political and social development from the late 1st millennium BC into the early 1st millennium AD. But Aksumite society existed on a larger scale. Cohaito, Keskese, Matara, Yeha, all seem to have continued as important Aksumite urban centers. They'd been occupied in this earlier time period in the first millennium BC, but they continue to be important during the Aksumite period. The archaeology that's been done at Aksum itself is almost totally an archaeology of elite architecture and monuments, including elite grave sites, what were probably royal residences, and areas around the stone stelae that I'll talk about in a moment. It's extremely difficult to tell how large the entire urban area of Aksum was. We really don't have the sort of survey evidence, archaeological survey evidence, that would be required to say that, nor do we know what the population of Aksum, of the capital of the Aksumite state, would have been. The real heyday of the Aksumite state was in the 3rd and 4th centuries AD, when a number of very significant developments occurred. This was first the period of maximum Aksumite influence, when the ruler at Aksum controlled not merely the base area in Ethiopia and Eritrea, but also parts of Sudan, as well as parts of Yemen and Arabia that were actually under the control of the Aksumite state. This was also the time when Aksum's trade networks were most extensive and most sophisticated. Remember that Aksum sits on the shores of the Red Sea, a vital economic lifeline connecting the Mediterranean basin with the Indian Ocean and ultimately East Asia. In a major economic advance at this time, the state issued its own coinage. And this was also the period when first the ruler and then the wider population converted to Christianity. And all of these different factors, all of these different processes and events are tied together. Christianity tied Axum into international networks of cultural and political interchange. It tied Axum to Alexandria, to Rome, to Constantinople. It acted as an extremely important unifying force in Ethiopia through the next 1600 years up until the present, and also probably contributed to the increasing isolation of Ethiopia from Arabia and the Nile Valley through time, especially after the establishment of Islam in these regions through the 7th and 8th centuries AD. Coinage made the state's internal workings more efficient. Ports like Adulis on the Red Sea coast exported products from the Ethiopian hinterland, including agricultural goods, ivory, gold, and probably slaves, to Rome, to India, and to every point in between. The Roman artifacts at Ok Aeo in Vietnam, a contemporary site to Axum that I mentioned in a previous lecture, may well have passed through Axumite hands. So think of this, Roman material coming through an Ethiopian state and eventually ending up in Vietnam in the early first millennium AD. The profits of this trade and exchange made Axum rich and powerful. By the 3rd and 4th centuries AD, there's evidence for significant increases in population densities and larger communities with increased social differences, as witnessed in the prevalence of monumental architecture, palaces, and these extraordinary stone stela, these stone columns found at Axum. Some of the stelae around Axum were 25 meters or 82 feet tall when they were erected. They were carved from single masses of stone. They're not put together from blocks. They're carved from a single piece of stone weighing between 160 and 170 tons. Extraordinary architectural accomplishments. These cultural developments are probably also connected to an increase in agricultural efficiency based on the spread of plowing, the spread of terrace agriculture, and possibly new crops. However, in the immediate vicinity of Axum, at least, there's some evidence of environmental deterioration through erosion during this period, and it's quite likely that the population increase that these innovations allowed was not sustainable over the long term. The Axumite state ruled most of the Ethiopian plateau over the period until the 7th or 8th centuries AD. But the last two centuries, the last part of this time period, were a time of contraction as trade routes were progressively severed by Persians and Arabs. This resulted in the gradual impoverishment of the Axumite state, with a loss of control of outlying areas and the gradual shift of the population and the political center of gravity of the state into the Ethiopian highlands. In this part of Africa, at the intersection of two continents, prosperity and cultural development often seem to have been tied to the maintenance of exchange networks over large areas. At the same time, we should be careful about ascribing themes to cultural developments in regions where the archaeology is not well known. In part, this practice is due to our relative ignorance, again and again, as archaeologists learn more about regions in different parts of the world, we find that their history and their cultural dynamics were more complicated and indeed more interesting than we usually expect. For my next lecture, I'm going to move on to an area which is equally complex, but complex in entirely different ways than the Axumite Empire, the inland Niger Delta of Mali in West Africa. Thank you.